It'd be a slow conversation. So kind of the hope is that somebody's broadcasting their encyclopedia so that we could pick up lots of new stuff. Questions? A gift, not from me. Okay, so we're talking about galaxies these days, and we had this big long sheet that summarized the history of how we discovered our galaxy. And it's kind of hard to give a short summary of it. The kind of key points, of course, is that the... Okay, so no transparencies today. Even the backup bulb is gone. I did phone it in a while ago. So the kind of key idea, which at first blush sounds funny, is that the globular clusters show the center of our galaxy. So, I mean, why the globular clusters is kind of the argument from the 1920s. They are asymmetric, but they're also pretty unusual objects. But that was the argument from Shapley that if we could figure out where the center of the globular clusters are, we'd know where the center of our galaxy was, and we could get our distance to it. The kind of goat in this story is the measurement of the rotation of distant so-called spiral nebula. According to this measurement, von Mann's measurement, they seem to be rotating backwards relatively quickly, and because they were rotating backwards, they had to be relatively close, so people interpreted them as being things like star systems in formation. More for me. So kind of if we're going to pick out an interesting winner in this, it would be Lindblad, because using this kind of dull data on the proper motion of nearby stars, and what's important is that information isn't corrupted by dust, right? If a star is moving so fast, it doesn't matter whether it seems dimmer or brighter, you still know how fast it's moving. So this was good data, but seemingly dull data. But by analyzing that data carefully, Lindblad actually had all of the right answers. The overall structure of our galaxy. Okay, so dust is, of course, the problem. This line of argument down here, and the solution to that was Trumpler, who looked at open clusters, and that's a good thing to look at if you want to see dust, because the open clusters are in the plane of the galaxy, and so they're going to be highly affected by the dust. And he showed that given the assumption that they had a pretty constant size, which is not a great assumption, that estimate of distance disagreed with the distance you got from main sequence fitting. So that showed there was systematic dust every place. Around the turn of the century, people had figured out that there were clouds of dust, but they hadn't thought that there was kind of dust every place. And of course, the problem is that other people measured the dust to globular clusters, and they found very little dust, right? Because there's no dust, basically, between the galaxies. So you really ought, this is kind of a typical question, you really ought to be able to reproduce this diagram of our galaxy. We've got a black hole in the center of our galaxy, 4 million times the mass of the sun. It may sound like a huge black hole, but we know of other galaxies that have black holes that are 1,000 times bigger than that. And if you compare that to the total mass of the galaxy, it's small change. So you shouldn't think about the black hole as dominating our galaxy, but seems to define the exact center of our galaxy. The spiral arms, that's where new stars seem to be formed. We've got gas and dust in them, giant molecular clouds. So we see blue stars that don't last very long, particularly in the spiral arms. That's one of the ways we match them. Globular clusters, and generally speaking, the unpolluted stars, the population 2 stars, are in the halo. Also, to some extent, in the nuclear bulge. The relatively recently formed stars that are polluted with metals, they're found in the disk. So our black hole doesn't seem to be eating anything recently. Other black holes are eating stars at the rate of maybe a dozen a year or hundreds a year. But even at those rates, that's small change compared to the several hundred billion stars. So we shouldn't really worry about the stars being depleted by the... Yeah, so how we measure the mass of these of our black hole is by plotting stars as in these huge orbits around the black hole. And certainly with time, those guys are going to be eaten by our black hole, but not at a huge rate. Yes, take billions of years to eat much. We will see, as I say, cases where we have central black holes that do seem to be eating a dozen stars a year, 100 stars a year, and they're interesting objects. So we think that if a black hole is eating, the material goes in this accretion disk, and instead of kind of going right down the hole, the friction of the spiral motion in heats it up to high temperatures, and it should be a source of X-rays. Incidentally, we do see X-rays from the center of our galaxy, but they don't seem to be concentrated in an accretion disk around our black hole. So the inner 10 light years of our galaxy seems to be a really kind of dynamic place, I guess, as you might imagine, if there's a huge black hole around it. But not nearly as dynamic, not a millionth as dynamic as other black holes. So a relatively compared to other massive black holes, pretty moderate. More questions? So our galaxy is a barred spiral galaxy. That means it has this kind of peanut in the center, which we call a bar. And we've got spiral arms. And it's really hard to see very far because of the dust. So putting together the spiral arms is difficult. So from the position of the sun, maybe we can follow the spiral arm about here. What happens as we get further away is less and less clear. So the number of spiral arms in our galaxy is something that is disputed. I personally believe 2, lots of people believe 4. It's hard to tell. And they're probably also what are called spurs, that is to say incomplete spiral arms. The sun's position is about a half or a third of the way out, and this is the one definite number you can talk about. There is a definite distance between the sun and the black hole, and it seems to be pretty much 27,000 light years. You'll see lots of different numbers for the size of this disk because it doesn't have a definite size. It doesn't end in any definite sort of way. So our book favors this number about 150,000 light years. Most books will favor a number about 100,000 light years, but it may seem like a big difference, but there just isn't an edge. Thickness of the disk, I wrote down 1,000 light years just to be an even number. Maybe a bigger number would be appropriate, but it turns out that different objects have kind of different distances. Some things are kind of puffed out and are more common at higher distances above the galactic plane. Remember that if we look at the velocity of stars near us, we see high velocity stars that are zipping through. And actually what's happening is that's part of the motion, the orbital motion of the sun around the plane of the galaxy. So we are whipping by them. So these population 2 objects have orbits that are not partaking in the rotation of the disk. And so as we are rotating, we'll see them moving at high speeds. The stars that are like the sun may have some small random velocity. We're all going basically 200 kilometers a second around the center of our galaxy. Remember that the arms aren't definite objects. They're just a pattern. And we talked, I think, probably 2 times ago about this story about the truck that's slowing down cars on the interstate. That's the sort of picture you should have about the spiral arms. So it turns out that gas is small change compared to stars, is small change compared to stuff that we don't know what it is, the so-called dark matter. Best guess at this point is that the dark matter is some sort of exotic particle, a weakly interacting massive particle, you know, maybe several times the mass of a proton. We detect this dark matter not by seeing it because it's dark. It's not producing any light. We detect it by its gravitational effect. And that is that if we look at the speed that things are moving around our galaxy, roughly speaking, things that once you get away from the center, things are moving at roughly speaking about 200 kilometers a second. And the mass that's enclosed by those orbits should go like the speed squared times the distance you are from the center. So apparently, as you look at bigger and bigger hunks of our galaxy, there's more and more mass. So even as we see fewer and fewer stars, there's still more mass as we go out. So the best guess is that most of the mass of our galaxy, 3/4 of it, 90%, is probably in the form of this dark matter. Questions? So then we went on to look at other types of galaxies, and although we don't have overhead projector, we do have pictures that we can look at, pretty pictures of galaxies. Well, let's start with spiral galaxies, I guess. Okay, so these are other galaxies, and really the way we know what our galaxy is by looking at other galaxies, right? We don't have pictures like this of our galaxy because we're stuck in the disk. But here you can see we have these red spots are H2 regions, so they're actually showing where those ultraviolet producing stars are. And you can see that there's lots of signs of dust, particularly in the spiral arms, but also in the whole disk. In this particular guy, the nucleus is relatively small compared to the galaxy. Well, if we look edge on, we're not going to see much except the dust along the edge. This particular guy doesn't have a particularly big nuclear bulge. There's a very clear bar. And very commonly when we have bars, we have two spiral arms. That's one of the reasons I think our galaxy has two spiral arms, though, as I say, it could have four. This is another example of kind of a C-type spiral galaxy where the nuclear bulge is relatively small. More examples. So M31 is the nearest spiral galaxy, and you might remember that in the observatory you looked at it and you just saw kind of a fuzzy ball. If we could actually see this dim object with our eyes, it would be bigger than the moon, and we can kind of just barely make out a spiral pattern in this visible light photograph. The M31 seems to be a galaxy a little bit bigger than ours, but it is another spiral galaxy. This is kind of an unusual galaxy, so maybe I shouldn't. Question? It's called the Sombrero Galaxy. I think for obvious reasons. It definitely has a disk, but it also has a very extended halo. Okay, so here we got elliptical galaxies. So no particular spiral subject. This is a relatively small elliptical galaxy. It happens to be a elliptical galaxy that's kind of a satellite of our galaxy. We'll talk probably mostly next time about jets and things that seem to be emanating from the black hole at the center of these galaxies, but right now the emphasis is on the overall what looks maybe cloudy like stuff, but is really just zillions of stars. Elliptical galaxies are the... So here's the same picture of that guy that isn't showing the jets. So this thing is about 50 million light years away from us. So we've got elliptical galaxies, and I've mentioned several times the large and the small Magellanic clouds. So here's a picture. These are kind of satellite galaxies of our galaxy. Here's the large Magellanic cloud. Here's the small Magellanic cloud. So you can see there's no particular structure, although some people say that they see spiral structure in the Magellanic clouds. One of the things we'll be talking about today is that galaxies come in clusters. So this is a cluster of galaxies. You can see all of these galaxies are, you know, kind of cheek to jowl in this particular cluster. Right? Another cluster. You might see these kind of circular arcs. That has to do with gravitational lensing, and maybe we'll get to talk about that today also. But you can see these galaxies are, you know, relatively speaking, close. And here's, I think we've talked about this before, this is the Hubble Deep Field. And basically every dot in this diagram, except I think that one, is a galaxy. So this looks kind of like a, you know, a made-up picture where you Photoshop together these things. But this is the way it is in the sky, things that are more or less together. I'm going to hold off on that. So I've talked long ago when we were talking about measures of distances, we talked about the Tully-Fisher relationship, and this is maybe as good a time as any to describe it. So what the Tully-Fisher relationship is doing is it's dealing with whole galaxies, right? So if we want to get distances, we need brighter and brighter objects as we're looking further and further. So supernovas, you know, are pretty bright, but a whole galaxy at least is something that we might be able to see at a greater distance. And what the Tully-Fisher relationship is a relationship between the rotation velocity of a spiral galaxy, so we're looking face-on spiral galaxies here, supposedly, and the overall brightness. So it turns out that the faster they're rotating, the brighter they are. And we have a kind of a nice relationship then between the This is the same one, but it's not the one I remember. Oh, next. That's what I wanted to do. So here we have a particular relatively low mass spiral galaxy, and if I increase the mass of that galaxy, it gets physically bigger and it rotates faster. And again, if we know the luminosity and we measure the brightness, then we can get the distance to the guy. Right, so for our galaxy, right, you remember that it has... How do I move this thing? It has a rotation. Oh, you're right. Thanks. So we've got a rotation velocity kind of in this range, right? 200 or so kilometers per second. We looked at most of the pretty pictures. I want to take a look at this picture, which is called Hubble's tuning fork. And one is kind of worried about taking it too seriously. So probably Hubble did take this seriously, and he thought that this had something to do with the history of galaxies. And we don't think that anymore, but it's just a way of kind of organizing the galaxies and thinking about them. So what we have are the relatively loose, small nucleus SC galaxies. And here these arms are wound so tight that it's hard to see where they are, relatively big nucleus for the SA spirals. And again, our galaxy is thought to, well, it's actually thought to be an SBB galaxy, kind of like that. So not only does the shape change as we move, but also lots of other things change, in particular, the amount of dust and gas. So these SCs tend to have more gas and dust than these SAs. And then we've got the ellipticals, which have basically no gas and dust. Now, one of the things that is less than happy about this historical document is that, that kind of the implication is that that E5s are different from E0s. And that's not necessarily the case. So a galaxy could be elliptical, but from your viewpoint, it could be an E0, right? If its point is pointing towards you. So a galaxy that has a particular shape could look pretty cigarish or could look pretty circular, just according to how it's oriented. So unlike the nomenclature for the spiral galaxies, where we think we're actually measuring something different about those galaxies, these things, this integer is just noticing the shape as it appears in our sky. And it's not necessarily telling us anything about what's going on inside of it. And in particular, these guys are probably more or less the same. Maybe not the same shape, but at least have the same basic characteristics. And those characteristics are basically an absence of gas and dust, so there's no new star formation there, so there aren't any blue stars, so you can see that they've shown them as kind of yellowish objects, in contrast to the spiral galaxies where we have gas and dust, so we have new stars in formation. And you remember the intermediate cases are the lenticulars, where we have a disk, but we don't have any sign of spiral arms. In this diagram, if we were going to put the irregulars on here, they're typically attached on this side because the irregulars tend to have even more gas and dust and new star formation than we've got in the spiral galaxies. In particular, you might remember that supernova 1987A came from the Large Magellanic Cloud, and as a type 2 supernova, it came about as a massive star death. So that had to be a newly formed star, just a few million years old, that exploded 150,000 years ago, and we just saw it in 1987. Questions? So it might be worth commenting that at least in my experience, when you look through a telescope, none of these things look nearly this good. They are just so dim that it really takes time exposures and photographs in order to see much of this structure. And I guess the last thing I have up on here is the kind of the end thing we had on our diagram, which was Hubble's discovery of the so-called expansion of the universe. So earlier it had been noticed that all of the galaxies, then called nebulae, except M31, are moving away from the Earth. And what Hubble did is he actually then went and found the distance to those galaxies, and he found a linear relationship between the speed that they were moving away from the Earth and the distance they were. And it turns out that's exactly as if you had an explosion sometime T ago. And we had fast-moving objects and slow-moving objects produced as a result of that explosion. So quite naturally, the things that are moving slower haven't gone as far. So if today we go and look at the distant velocity relationship, we find that there's a linear relationship between the speed and the distance. We don't literally believe that this is what's going on, but I think it's a good thing to keep in mind, and in particular recognize that Hubble's constant, which is the coefficient of d, is really just 1 over the time since this explosion, or at least approximately 1 over the time since this explosion. So, you know, in 1930, distance measurements were really hard. And Hubble had his distances off by nearly a factor of 10, so he had the Hubble constant off by about a factor of 10. So according to him, the explosion happened about 2 billion years ago, whereas we know it happened, these days we know it happened 13.7 billion years ago. Questions? Say again? Below irregular, peculiar.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is another example. You know, often I try and give you a complete list of things, even if we haven't talked about them. So we haven't talked about irregular galaxies. I guess I just talked about them a second ago, or peculiar galaxies. But we did last time talk about the lenticulars, the ellipticals, and the two types of spirals. Center.
Center, okay.
Yep. So what this is saying is that as we look, for our solar system, Pluto is moving fewer miles per hour than we are. So if we were to look at further and further objects, they'd be going slower and slower. But that's not true here. Everything seems to be going at pretty much the same speed until we get very close to this black hole. And then there are all sorts of kind of funny things happen. More questions.
How do we know the time, 13 million years ago?
Yeah. So I keep giving you three significant digits. I think that's a question for the future. It's very surprising, is I guess what I would say, that we have all of those digits. One of the claims of fame of the Hubble Space Telescope was that it was supposed to give us a good value for the Hubble constant, which gives you a good handle on the approximate time since the Big Bang. But it's still about unsure by about 10%, which doesn't allow you to say 13.7 billion years ago. So this astounding accuracy is a product of something I don't want to talk about yet. It is something that basically won 2 Nobel Prizes over time. And I guess I can give it a name, the microwave background radiation. More questions? Well, I got kind of three things on my list to talk about from the current chapter, which is 24. The first one has to do with structure. So if you had asked Newton kind of what the shape of the universe was, in one of his letters he hints that he kind of thinks about it as the stars sprinkled more or less randomly all over space. And then we learn that there is structure to it, that at least the stars nearby are organized in this galaxy, and we have lots of galaxies. Well, are the galaxies kind of sprinkled randomly around in space, or is there some sort of structure? And the answer is there is structure, right? We just talked about clusters of galaxies. But you might remember I also commented that M31 seems to be different from all the other galaxies because it's actually approaching our galaxy. So what we have there is kind of a binary galaxy. So M31 and our galaxy are somehow gravitationally connected. And currently, M31 is coming towards our galaxy. It's really hard to figure out how much sideways motion there is, because that would require a measurement of proper motion, and it's 2 million light years away. So even if we're going pretty fast sideways, it would be really hard to measure. But the current best measurements is there will basically be a collision, or at least a near miss, between our galaxy and M31 in the hugely distant future. But M31 and our galaxy correspond what's called the local group. And there are all of these other small galaxies for us, like the Large and Small Magellanic Cloud and LEO 1, that kind of buzz around the two big guys, which are M31 and the Milky Way galaxy. The local group is in turn kind of a neighbor of the Virgo cluster. So you might remember that these two guys are about 2.5 million light years apart. And the size of those disks is on the order of 100,000 light years. So they are, you know, like frisbees that are separated from here to the wall. In the Virgo cluster, we've got on the order of 1,000 galaxies. And it separated from us by about 50 million light years. And there are lots of other clusters that are known in the neighborhood. Well, maybe I should have shown that picture too, but I guess I won't now that it's turned on the lights. So we've plotted lots of these clusters, and we start to see superclusters. Clusters of clusters. And if we kind of put the biggest scale picture together, we have a picture that, I don't know, looks kind of like foam. We have areas where we have lots of galaxies. I'll call these walls. And we have things that are called voids where there are relatively few galaxies. Right, so this might be the Virgo cluster is a small piece of that wall that is all around us. So galaxies don't seem to be placed kind of randomly around. There is a certain amount of structure. We have small groups, we have big groups of 1,000, we have superclusters, that is to say clusters of clusters, and we have regions where there are relatively few galaxies, period. The superclusters kind of define the walls of this foam-like structure that we see around us. And of course, in order to make this sort of picture, it's absolutely critical that you have some recognition of distance, right? Because if you don't know that this distance is different from that distance, you're just going to see those two galaxies as being in the same direction of the sky, and you might guess that they're in fact related. And historically, that's been a problem. So it took relatively good measurements of distance, which are based on having relatively good values of the Hubble constant, in order to get that distance. And maybe that's worth stressing. The velocity is easy to measure, right? All you have to do is take a spectra and look at how the lines are shifted. And so if you believe Hubble's law, you can easily measure the velocity and therefore calculate the distance to those guys. And that'll work for most any galaxy. In order to use the Tully-Fisher relationship to get a distance, you need a spiral galaxy, first of all. And these things are kind of roughly co-equal. There are about as many elliptical galaxies as there are barred spirals, as there are normal spirals. So there are lots of things that you wouldn't be able to apply Tully-Fisher to in order to get the distance. And also, if the galaxy is face-on to you, you can't get the velocity of the rotation, right? So you need some amount of tilt, at least, in order to measure the rotation velocity via the Tully-Fisher relationship. But Hubble, you can apply to any old object and get a reasonably good value of the distance. So in the last decade, there have been lots of big surveys that have mapped out this kind of foam-like structure that seems to define the shape of the universe. So if we see galaxies and local groups of galaxies and clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies, you know, are there super-duper clusters of galaxies, right? Is there clustering beyond what we know about? And, of course, we can't ever be sure about that, but as far as we can tell, there's no hint of anything beyond this structure of walls and voids. That seems to be the... you can apparently just stamp that all over the universe and have a good idea of what the universe looks like as a whole. Okay. Dark matter. So I introduced dark matter in our galaxy, where we would measure the speed of stars that are in our galaxy but are distant from us, and the speed showed no sign of decline, which meant that there had to be ever more mass, even as we saw fewer and fewer stars. So whatever was constituting the mass was not producing light, and so it gained the name dark matter. So the first thing we can do is we can check this out with other spirals. In fact, it's actually easier to do with other spirals than it is with our own galaxy. And we can plot this rotation curve, and while we have slow-moving spirals and fast-moving spirals, we don't see any cases. Yeah, that's a good enough statement, I guess. We don't see cases where there's declines. So it seems like our galaxy is normal in that most of the matter is dark matter. You can play the same game with elliptical galaxies. Remember, think about an elliptical galaxy is kind of like a bee swarm. And you know that if these bees are moving fast enough, they will have an escape velocity and they'll escape that elliptical galaxy. So you can easily measure how fast those stars are going, and you can calculate the mass that would be required to keep them in one place. And it turns out, consistently, the mass that's required to hold that elliptical galaxy together is more than the mass of all of the stars that are in that galaxy. So it seems like spirals aren't any different from ellipticals. There's more matter there than we can see. Well, we can play this same game, except now let's expand the scale. So a moment ago I was talking about stars in an elliptical galaxy. Now let's talk about galaxies that are in a cluster of galaxies. Right, we can measure the velocity of all of those galaxies in that cluster of galaxies, and we can calculate the mass that would be required to hold that cluster together. And once again, in fact, even more so, there's matter that is not in the form of stars. We can calculate the mass of all of those galaxies. We add it up, and it's not enough mass to hold the cluster together, that we need even more mass than is in the form of visible light. Well, if we don't believe any of these things, we have other ways of doing basically the same thing. And one of the clever ones has to do with the effect of gravity on light. Right, this is a consequence of Einstein's general theory of relativity, that we know that matter, as it swishes by the sun, will be pulled towards the sun, but it turns out that light is the same way. So if we have a distant galaxy and an even more distant galaxy, we can see the bending that the nearby galaxy is doing to the light from the more distant galaxy. And we can calculate how much mass it would take to cause that bending, and we can calculate thereby the mass of the galaxy that's doing the bending. So this is called gravitational lenses. And the effect is usually to elongate. So you remember in that picture of the cluster that is now not visible, there seemed to be not uncommonly a bunch of kind of arcs like that of light. And what these arcs are is they are the distorted image of a galaxy that's way behind this cluster of galaxies. It's been distorted by this gravitational lens. There's kind of a third and a fourth way of doing it. The fourth one is going to wait for a few weeks. And that is to say, it turns out that clusters of galaxies, so I'm now pointing at these dots, thinking about them as a cluster of galaxies, they're typically filled with extremely hot gas, which, because it is extremely hot, is producing X-rays. And you know, you have that hot gas. Is it moving fast enough to escape that cluster? So you can measure the temperature of that gas so you know how fast the atoms are moving. You can calculate how much mass it would be required in order to keep that gas confined. And again, we get more mass than is in visible stars. So I don't know, starting in, say, 1970 to 1990, all of this data was put together until people realized that it just had to be the case, that most of what the universe is made out of is not something that we know anything about. So this is kind of the the ultimate in the Copernican effect, right? So Copernicus moved us from the center of the universe to the periphery, and we find that the sun is the periphery of a galaxy, and it's not even the biggest galaxy in the local cluster, and the local cluster is small change compared to the Virgo cluster, and there's a supercluster out there too. Not only all of that, but the stuff that we're made out of is not even the normal stuff of the universe. Whatever we're made out of, atoms, is not the bulk of the material of the universe. Certainly there's way more dark matter than there is normal matter, and we'll learn in a couple of weeks that there's more so-called dark energy than there is dark matter. So maybe a few percent of the universe is in stuff like you and me. Most of the universe is in radically other different stuff, which mostly we don't know what it is. I think I commented that there are active people trying to detect these WIMPs. In particular, the Sudan mine has a big detector that is trying to see these guys whizzing through their detector. And since they're weakly interact, presumably, just as there are zillions of neutrinos that are going through your body every second, there would be zillions of these weakly interacting particles also going through your body. But because they're weakly interacting, they're really hard to detect. So that's the aim of that project, at least. Try and see them directly, as opposed to just see them by the gravitational influence that they've got. Okay, so the structure of the universe isn't disorganized. It seems to have this pattern of clustering that finally seems to end in this foam. And we've got evidence of dark matter on lots of different scales. So the last thing I want to mention in chapter 24, is what's called the look-back effect. So, looking at me, you don't see me as I am now, right? You see me as I was 10 nanoseconds earlier, right? Because it takes 10 nanoseconds for the light from my nose to reach your eyes. And when we're looking at the sun, we're not seeing the way it is now, we're seeing the way it was 7 minutes, because it takes 7 minutes for light to travel from the surface of the sun. So when we're looking at more and more distant objects, we're literally seeing the past, because it takes time for light to get from point A to point B. So when we're looking at the Virgo cluster, we're not seeing it the way it is now, we're seeing it the way it was 50 million years ago. Now, 50 million years isn't that big in the history of galaxies, but as we go further and further distances, we're automatically going further and further back in time. So we should literally be able to see the past just by looking at very distant objects. So all we have to do is go and look at objects that are 10 billion light years from us, and we have an idea what was happening just 3.7 billion years after the Big Bang. We can see relatively young objects. So kind of for scale, how far back can we push it? Well, to something like 13.2 billion years. So we can get within half a billion years or so of the Big Bang just by looking at more and more distant objects. And the claim to fame for doing this is, of course, to push that even further back. Now, having said this, there is a problem that automatically occurs. And it's both a problem, it's both a curse and a benefit, I guess. Remember that we can measure the distances to these objects because we're looking at the recession speed. And we get the recession speed by the Doppler shift. But the Doppler shift is going to be shifting that wavelength out of the optical range into the infrared range, into the radio range, and it'll become harder and harder to detect it. So further distance means more Doppler effect. Which means that the light of the stars we're looking at, maybe it was originally visible light, and it's going to be infrared light, it's going to be microwave light, as we look at more and more distant objects. So So it turns out that the most distant objects we see with microwave antennas as opposed to visible light. But we think if we were actually to go visit that time and place, what we would see is visible light, right? It's just been shifted hugely by the Doppler effect. So we usually measure this wavelength shift by what's called the Z parameter. It's the change in wavelength divided by the wavelength. So anything in our galaxy, the shift in wavelength is less than a thousandth of the wavelength. So pretty small Doppler effects unless you're going pretty fast. So how much can the wavelength shift? Well, kind of the most distant objects, the redshift is by about a factor of 7. So that means the wavelength is now 8 times longer than it was when it was emitted. So you need a different sort of telescope to see stars that are presumably more or less identical to the stars we have today. So there's a great emphasis, therefore, on putting infrared telescopes, very sensitive telescopes, in space in order to see these very, very, very distant objects. So one thing that is maybe a little bit confusing that I'll spend a second on is when we were talking about Doppler effect, we said the shift in wavelength was about equal to the velocity divided by the velocity of light. But obviously, you can't have a velocity that is 7 times the speed of light. So this formula that we were talking about in the context of the Doppler effect, it's only good for relatively small velocities. And Einstein has corrections to that that shows that as the velocity approaches the speed of light, the change in wavelengths gets ever, ever, ever larger and has no problem going to 7, 8, 9, 10, 100, 1,000. And about a wavelength shift of 1,000 is about as far as we've measured with any sort of telescope. So what do we see? If we look at distant objects, how does the distant, which is to say young universe, differ from the universe that we've got in our immediate vicinity? Well, to me at least, when I look at the data, my conclusion is not much. If you were to go back about 10 billion years, you know, twice the history of this planet, things aren't very different. You'd still have spiral galaxies, you'd still have elliptical galaxies. The spirals hardly change at all. And I don't know, to me, little change is maybe a factor of 2 change. So they were maybe had twice as much star formation as we've got now. Right? There's only so much gas that will get used up eventually. But they were spitting out stars at only about twice as fast as they are today. For the ellipticals, there is a noticeable change. So remember that ellipticals have no current star formation because they have no gas. And it looks like ellipticals basically used up all their gas in one burst of star formation. So currently, ellipticals are red objects because all of the blue stars died in the first million years after they were formed. If we go back far enough, we start to see ellipticals that have the blue color that would be... Okay, so I guess I should make it clear. If we correct for this effect, right, so they're going to be red just because of the Doppler effect, but if we correct the wavelengths that they would have if we were actually visiting them, then they are bluer objects than they are today. So ellipticals seem to have one burst of star formation, whereas spirals have ongoing star formation. All the gas and dust was used up in ellipticals once, whereas spirals are conserving what they've got, as it were. The other thing we see is signs of formation. So if we look at the Large Magellanic Cloud, it turns out that we can trace gas and dust that goes back to our galaxy. So evidently the Magellanic Cloud had a collision with our galaxy in the distant past, and we now have kind of this trail of debris that is connecting our galaxy to the Large Magellanic Cloud. It might be worth commenting that the stars are hugely small compared to the distances between them. So you could take two spiral galaxies and push them right through each other, and it would be very unlikely for any stars to collide. But the gas, since it is in clouds as opposed to basically point sources, that they will collide, and we will have streams of gas and dust that are left behind when galaxy A goes by galaxy B. And it looks like the formation of galaxies, this is less and less clear. It looks like, yep? Pretty much what you would expect, right? So it becomes less and less likely to have literally a head-on collision. So you're probably going to have a more tangential collision. And we already see binary stars which look like that. That is to say, where the atmosphere of one star connects to the other star. And you remember that there isn't much out here anyway. Right? That's very rarefied material. So most likely what would happen is just they'd go out, there'd be a collision, there'd be gas and dust that would be released, but the stars would continue on. And I think I've commented that when the sun expands out to include at least the planet Venus and maybe the planet Earth, Venus would probably continue to orbit inside of the sun for quite a period of time as a molten slag, because there just isn't much there, right? By earthly standards, the surface of the sun is moderately good vacuum. Incidentally, this picture of stars forming as a way of spinning out material was an early idea for how the planetary systems might have formed. Not an idea that's accepted today. The Laplacian idea of this nebula that grows is the accepted idea. Basically, because collisions are just too rare. It's very unlikely for collisions to occur. Okay, so in terms of galaxies, where we can have collisions, because the size separation is not huge, right? So remember that, you know, Andromeda is one of these things over against the wall. That's hugely different from when we were talking about the solar system, right? So the solar system was the sun here, and the Earth was someplace out in the hall. And of course, the Earth was this tiny dot in addition. And the solar system is relatively dense, right? If we were to ask where the nearest star was, it was in some other state. So we can have collisions between galaxies because compared to their sizes, their separations aren't that much. You saw in those pictures of the clusters of galaxies that they're kind of cheek to jowl. And in fact, we have pictures of cases where we have spiral galaxy A and spiral galaxy B clearly in collision between their two spots. So galaxies do collide, and they probably merge and form larger galaxies. So if we were to guess how our galaxy formed, we guess that it came together by having little bits and pieces, like the Large Magellanic Cloud, slowly come together to form the current size. And kind of a further hint about formation is if you took a spiral galaxy and you stripped out the gas and dust, and you waited a few million years so that the blue stars would die, what you would see then would be the bulge. And it would look a lot like a elliptical galaxy. So elliptical galaxies may form in part by stripping the gas from a spiral galaxy. Questions about galaxies? Any place you have gas, you'd expect that there'd be star formation. And there are hints of cases where we think that a gas-rich galaxy has accreted to an elliptical and we see signs of star formation. But, you know, this isn't a movie that we can see, so it's always a matter that we see X and then we try and imagine how we could get to X. More questions? Kind of another question that you should maybe keep in the back of your mind is it sure looks like at the center of most, if not all, galaxies, there's a black hole. So if we have a collision between two galaxies, kind of what happens to the black hole? Now, I don't think people are prepared to answer that question. There are some cases where we do see what looks like binary black holes, and we think that those probably came about by a collision. But really beyond that, you can't say with any degree of accuracy. Questions? Yeah, so I meant to, but I didn't look up what the time frame is for this collision. And as I say, the what I do know is that the best estimates now is that it will be a collision and not a miss. But it's really hard to measure the tangential velocities. So the galaxies combine just fine, and the mostly what happens is nothing, right? The sun will continue to orbit. The orbit might be perturbed by the neighboring galaxy, but it doesn't really matter where the sun is. The Earth would presumably continue to orbit the sun. So not so much a big deal, but with a big but that I'm about to get to. And it has to do with this black hole. So one of the things that could start to happen is that as you start to perturb the orbits of this gas and dust that has been missing the black hole, you know, for all of these eons, because we don't have a particularly active black hole. But best guess is that the gravitational perturbations would lead to a lot of this material being dumped on that black hole. So the black hole could brighten tremendously and at least put the name up today. Quasar, quasi-stellar objects, QSOs, quasi-stellar objects, are believed to be cases where we have a black hole that is feeding. And they're tremendously bright, tremendously high energy producing objects. And it's possible that, well, it's not clear that you would want to be anywhere near a black hole that is feeding. So it might be that the very indirect effect that because of the collision, gas goes into the black hole, which leads to a lot of high energy processes, which might be unpleasant for people in the neighborhood. Yes, yep, it's not something that you want to have happen. Incidentally, there are kind of hints that there was an explosion, a lot of material getting dumped into the center of our galaxy in the not hugely distant past. We see gas and dust that's expanding around the center of our galaxy. So this may happen periodically. Well, I'm not sure what you mean by the lifetime of the Earth. So the future of life on this planet is pretty limited. So I think I've told you lots of times that well before the sun expands, in about a billion years, the oceans will boil away. So unless we move off this planet, we're done on what I would call relatively short time scales. But the sun itself is going to live for another 5 billion years, 6 billion years. Well, Earth is a pretty big object, right? I'm pretty sure that it'll be a lot cheaper to move the people than move the planet. I mean, you might think that if things work out right, you could move out to Mars and it would be just toasty nice there. More questions. So, we've talked about irregular galaxies. A lot of these peculiar galaxies, we think, are galaxies that are in collision, And so they don't have any of these kind of natural shapes. And these collisions seem to be not at all uncommon. It's pretty easy to find cases where we see two galaxies that are very close together and we think are gravitationally interacting with each other. So collisions among galaxies is not a rare event the way collisions among stars are. Yeah, so we have no particular necessity to be part of a galaxy.
Okay.
So you could, if you could somehow transport us halfway between us and Andromeda, we would continue to orbit just fine.
Yeah, all of our
no more constellations.
From the sun.
Say again? Yeah, all of our, for all intents and purposes, all of our energy comes from the sun.
Okay.
Now, occasionally people talk about the formation of planets requiring kind of a nice distance from the center of the galaxy. That if you're too far out, there won't be as much pollution, and of course we need pollution to make bodies out of. And if you're too close, it might have been too vigorous early on and it may just be not a nice place to happen. So some, just as people talk about a habitable zone around a star where the temperatures are about right, some people talk about a habitable zone around our galaxy. So that planets could only form in this ring. I'm not sure I'm a believer in that, but. Well, we are constantly gaining energy, but we're also shining. And so every object that has a temperature is producing light. So so the Earth is shining, just not in visible light. So as much energy that the Earth gains from the sun, it's re-releasing. So we're pretty much in equilibrium. So I started to talk about quasi-stellar objects, and that's kind of the next topic, to talk about unusual stars. And I guess I should put both of those in quotes because it's going to turn out that quasars are not stars, they're galaxies. And most of these things can go together under the topic of active galactic nuclei. So kind of the history of these things is that when people first turned on their radio telescopes, they saw very fuzzy pictures, because of course radio telescopes don't give you very accurate images. They saw things that probably were not stars, right? Because the things that produce radio light are different from the things that produce visible light. When people looked carefully at some of these objects, they saw an unusual blue star. Which seemed to be the source of this radio light. And one of the ways this correspondence was done was by using the occultation of the moon. Right? Because remember, you get these very fuzzy pictures of these times at these times with radio telescopes before interferometers. So you could locate exactly the moment when the radio source kicked out because the moon was between us and that source, and exactly the time when the light from that star kicked out. And you could see that it happened at the same time, so they had to be the same source. So these things are all, relatively speaking, dim. Kind of the brightest one that you could see, you couldn't see with binoculars, but you could see with a telescope. So none of these objects are particularly bright. And when people looked at the spectra of this seemingly stellar object, quasi-stellar object, it wasn't a normal spectra. It didn't satisfy any of the criteria to be an O star or a B star or an A star. It wasn't the spectra of gas, which was fluorescent. It was a continuous spectra. And pretty much in this class, we've said that continuous spectra are thermal spectra. But that was not the case for these things. So instead of showing, you know, kind of this typical bell-shaped curve, what we saw is that when last seen, they were rising. So this was called the big blue bump. They were producing lots of high-energy light, and it wasn't the proper shape to be a thermal spectra. Furthermore, for stars, we've always talked about absorption lines, because a star has an atmosphere, and as the light escapes the atmosphere, certain colors are going to be eaten. And here we had the opposite. We had emission lines. Okay, well, that's good, right? Because emission lines, we just look up in the book to see what element is producing those emission lines. Nothing matches. So this was, talking now 60s, this was quite a quandary. And the solution turned out to be quite unexpected. What we had is huge Doppler effects. So for stars in our galaxy, for any star you can see with your naked eye, the Doppler shift is microscopic. It takes really good instruments to measure the slight difference in wavelengths. Parts in 10,000, parts in 100,000 shifts in wavelengths. But here we had shifts in wavelengths that were 10%, 20%, 30%. Most recently, 7. So big shifts in wavelengths were present in these blue stars. And if they have a huge Doppler effect, and if Hubble's law is correct, and actually in the 60s there were some people who disputed that, this also meant that they had to be hugely distant. And remember why these things are not bright. They're not as bright as I say, you can't see them with your eyes, you can't see them with binoculars, but at these huge distances, they would have to be hugely bright. And the other thing that was discovered about them is they seem to change their magnitude. So you know we've talked about variable stars before, pulsing stars, and these stars were pulsing, changing their brightness, and in a manner that's not that different from a Cepheid variable star. You know, weeks, maybe sometimes days. But on the other hand, if these things are hugely bright and hugely distant, they have to be hugely big, you would think. And so big things can't change their light output in less time than it takes light to go from one side of the object to the other. So they had to be smaller than a light week in size. In contrast to our galaxy, right, which is 100,000 light years in size. So they were something that was producing as much light as a galaxy, but on a really small object, because they're able to change their brightness. And they have this really funny spectra. So, big questions answered in chapter 25.